Chapter 2. Desire and Happiness. Desire, Frustration, and Self-Control. We are living in a realm of desire. From the moment we wake up until the moment we fall asleep at night, and even throughout our dreams, we are driven by desire. Each of our senses is hungry for its own particular food. Our eye craves to see interesting shapes and colors. Our ear wants to hear pleasing sounds. Our nose actively sniffs out agreeable odors and turns away in disgust from smells that offend it. Our tongue seeks exciting new tastes, and our sense of touch is forever craving contact of one kind or another. This desire for sensory stimulation is so deeply ingrained that if we are isolated from sights, sounds, smells, and so forth for long enough, we begin to hallucinate them. Our desires are not limited to the things we can see, hear, smell, taste, and touch. Our mind itself runs after ideas as greedily as our tongue hungers for tastes. Abstractions such as knowledge, reputation, security, and contentment are pursued with as much vigor as if they were things that could be held in the hand or seen by the eye. Desire is so pervasive, in fact, that it is doubtful whether there is anything that we do that is not motivated by it. No matter what field we may be involved in, whether it be business, sport, or even spiritual pursuits, it is desire of one form or another that drives us to achieve success in it. Desires are such an integral part of our life that most people would consider life without them to be a living death. Behind all of our desires is the wish to be happy. In this respect, everyone is exactly equal, for we all want happiness, even though we may define it differently. And none of us wishes even the slightest suffering or disappointment. If we check up carefully, we can see that all our actions are motivated by either the desire to experience what is pleasurable or the desire to avoid experiencing the unpleasant. Yet, in spite of all our wishes to have nothing but happiness, our life is full of pain and dissatisfaction. Our prized possession that we worked so hard for either breaks, is lost or stolen, or simply ceases to give us pleasure. Our loving husband or wife soon becomes our worst enemy, or dies and leaves us forlorn. The job we coveted turns into a heavy burden that consumes all our time and energy. Our reputation is smeared. Our smooth skin becomes wrinkled. Our intelligence starts to fade. In all these ways, then, desired happiness eludes our grasp. Sometimes it seems that the more we try to be happy, the more miserable we become. From this point of view, life seems to be a meaningless rat race. Our efforts to find happiness lead us around in circles until we end up frustrated and exhausted. Many different philosophers and spiritual teachers have described this circle of perpetual frustration and have offered advice on how to break free from it, or at least on how to put up with it. Shakyamuni Buddha referred to this condition of repeated dissatisfaction as samsara, a Sanskrit term meaning to wander or to circle, and prescribed many different methods for liberating ourselves from it. In the most well-known of his teachings, the source of all our problems and disappointments is said to be ignorantly produced desire itself. Liberation, or nirvana, is achieved by completely uprooting all such craving desire from our heart. Because our eyes, ears, nose, and so forth are the very gateways of desire, those wishing to break free and achieve liberation from this circle of suffering are encouraged to become especially distrustful of the five physical senses. These are to be recognized as exerting an unhealthy control over the mind and must be treated with the utmost caution. The behavior of someone following this path to individual liberation is therefore characterized by extreme self-control. The practitioner posts a strict guard at the door of the senses and is extremely suspicious of whatever wants to enter. If, for example, a desirable sight should appear, such as an attractive man or woman, the practitioner is advised to be alert to the possible danger of falling under its spell. When following this type of training, we combat the tendency of running blindly after objects of attachment and thereby falling victim to pain and disappointment. By teaching ourselves to focus on those aspects of the object that will reduce our desire for it. For instance, we can neutralize our longing for a beautiful person by concentrating on the unclean parts of his or her body. The aim of this type of practice is to keep desire from upsetting our minds, and the intended result is to attain a peacefulness and tranquility that cannot be disturbed by the changing fortunes of our life. Compared to a system like Tantra, which actually uses the energy of desire, this cautious approach to the spiritual path is considered inferior. But this is not to say that such an approach has no value. On the contrary, it is crucial to know when it is appropriate to withdraw our attention from things that disturb our mind. However, if the only way we know how to deal with desirable objects is to avoid them, there will be a severe limit as to how far our spiritual practice can take us. Tantra's approach is very different. Instead of viewing pleasure and desire as something to be avoided at all costs, Tantra recognizes the powerful energy aroused by our desires to be an indispensable resource for the spiritual path. Because the goal is nothing less than the realization of our highest human potential, Tantra seeks to transform every experience, no matter how unreligious it may appear, into the path of fulfillment. It is precisely because our present life is so inseparably linked with desire that we must make use of desire's tremendous energy if we wish to transform our life into something transcendental. Thus, the logic of Tantra is really very simple. Our experience of ordinary pleasure can be used as the resource for attaining the supremely pleasurable experience of totality, or enlightenment. It is natural that qualities of the mind, when cultivated, produce something similar, not opposite, to themselves. This is true for both positive and negative states of mind. In the same way that dissatisfaction itself can never become satisfaction, misery does not naturally evolve into happiness. According to Tantra, we cannot hope to attain our goal of universal and complete happiness by systematically making ourselves more and more miserable. This is contrary to the way things actually work. It is only by cultivating small experiences of calm and satisfaction now that we will be able to achieve our ultimate goal of peace and tranquility in the future. And similarly, it is only through the skillful use of desirous energy and by building up the habit of experiencing what we might call true pleasure that we can hope to achieve the everlasting bliss and joy of full illumination. Religion and the rejection of pleasure. It often seems, however, that there is a great contradiction between experiencing pleasure and following a spiritual or religious path. For many people, in fact, religion means nothing more than a denial or a rejection of the pleasurable parts of life. It is seen as saying no to desire, no to spontaneity, no to freedom of expression. No wonder, then, that organized religion has such a bad name. Instead of being a method for transcending our limitations, religion itself is viewed as one of the heaviest forms of suppression. It is just another form of superstition to be overcome if we really want to be free. Unfortunately, the way in which many societies have used religion as a means of political oppression and control justifies this harsh judgment. This view of religion as something that oppresses or restricts our basic human nature is held not only by its critics, but by many religious practitioners as well. There are a lot of people who feel that the proper way of following a spiritual discipline is by denying their simple humanity. They have become so suspicious of pleasure that they think there is actual value in being miserable. I am a religious person, so I shouldn't enjoy myself. Although their aim is to achieve some form of eternal peace and happiness, they make a point of denying themselves the everyday pleasures of life. They view these pleasures as obstacles, hindrances to spiritual development, and if they happen to experience a small amount of pleasure, they feel uncomfortable. They cannot even eat a piece of chocolate without thinking they are sinful and greedy. Instead of accepting and enjoying such an experience for what it is, they tie themselves up in a knot of guilt and self-reproach. While so many people in the world are starving and miserable, how dare I indulge myself in this way? But all such attitudes are completely mistaken. There is no reason at all to feel guilty about pleasure. This is just as mistaken as grasping on to passing pleasures and expecting them to give us ultimate satisfaction. In fact, it is just another form of grasping, another way of locking ourselves into a limited view of who we are and what we can become. Such guilt is a perversion of spirituality, not a true spiritual attitude at all. If we were truly content with our situation, happy and peaceful when encountering good and bad conditions alike, there might be some real value in practicing self-denial. It could be used beneficially to strengthen our sense of detachment or to help us understand what is truly important in our life. But we rarely deprive ourselves of something for the right reasons. We squeeze ourselves into a state of misery because we think that being miserable is itself somehow worthwhile. But it is not worthwhile. If we wallow in misery, the only result is that we experience even more misery. On the other hand, if we know how to experience happiness without the polluted attitudes of either grasping attachment or guilt, we can cultivate deeper and deeper levels of this experience and eventually attain the inconceivable happiness of our full human potential. If the fearful, self-restrictive approach that I have criticized is mistaken, then what is the skillful approach of someone seriously interested in realizing his or her highest potential? Stated simply, it is to keep the mind continuously in as happy and peaceful a condition as possible. Rather than letting ourselves follow habitual patterns of grasping, dissatisfaction, confusion, misery, and guilt, we should try to improve our mind by developing deeper and deeper levels of understanding, more skillful control of our mental and physical energies, ever higher forms of happiness and bliss, and a better life. Such an approach makes much more sense than trying to reject our everyday experiences. This is the logic of Tantra. Buddha and the Path of Enjoyment. Certain episodes in the life of Shakyamuni Buddha himself clearly demonstrate the superiority of an approach that uses desire-producing objects over a self-denying approach that forbids them. When he left the isolated and indulgent life of a prince at the age of 29 and was just beginning his quest for the cessation of suffering, Buddha, then simply the Bodhisattva Siddhartha, took up the discipline of extreme self-mortification. As some people still do in India today, he sought to uproot the causes of misery and dissatisfaction by beating his bodily senses into submission. He denied himself food and other comforts to such an extent that eventually he was little more than a skeleton. After 6 years of such self-deprivation, he realized that this approach was fruitless. Instead of bringing him closer to his goal of transcendence, it was only making him too weak to think and meditate clearly. At this point, he decided to give up this inflexible approach and follow a path more suitable to true spiritual development. The traditional accounts of his life relate that he broke his prolonged fast with a meal of milk rice offered by a woman named Sujata. The effect this food had on his body and mind was extraordinary. It filled him with strength, clarity, and bliss. This sudden resurgence of mental and physical energy increased not only his determination, but also his ability to gain the full enlightenment that was his goal. The fact that he then went on to achieve complete liberation after only one night's meditation under the Tree of Enlightenment clearly shows that the time was ripe for him to abandon his previous ascetic practices. From a tantric point of view, these events show that the path of utilizing pleasure and desire is far more profound and effective than the path of rigid self-denial. Later, after Buddha had become well known as a highly realized teacher capable of guiding all different types of people to fulfillment, a king requested to be shown a path of spiritual development suitable for someone with important social obligations. "As a king, I have the responsibility of taking care of my subjects," he explained, "and it would be wrong for me to abandon them. I cannot do as you did, give everything away, go into the jungle, and follow the ascetic life. What I need is a way of using the royal life itself as a path to spiritual fulfillment. Therefore, if you have a method for transforming my everyday actions as a king into a spiritual path, please teach it to me." Buddha replied that he did, in fact, have such a method. the practice of Tantra. With this method, you can continue to discharge your responsibilities, he explained, and need not give up any of your royal pleasures. He told the king that he could, in fact, enjoy himself as much as possible, and still be progressing toward enlightenment. The teaching that Buddha gave the king was the Kala Chakra, cycle of time, Tantra, and the lineages of this and many other tantric teachings have remained unbroken and powerful up to the present day. Countless Indians and Tibetans have achieved full enlightenment by following these methods, and there is absolutely no reason why Westerners cannot benefit in the same way. Following the path today. Tantra is particularly well-suited to the Western mentality. Being the quickest of all paths, it should appeal strongly to the West's love of instant results. Furthermore, the path of Tantra is essentially one of transformation, and the principle of transformation of energy, on a material level at least, is well understood in the West. Finally, while the great explosion of desirous energy in this century is considered to be a serious obstacle to most spiritual paths, it is actually helpful for the practice of Tantra, where desire is the fuel propelling us to our highest destination. Perhaps only a path like Tantra, with its emphasis on direct experience rather than blind acceptance, can rouse us out of our self-destructive patterns and give us the opportunity to fulfill ourselves completely. However, if we are to derive real value from this path, we have to be clear about certain important points. First of all, our motivation for practicing Tantra must be as pure as possible. This point will be discussed at great length later. See Chapter 6. For now, it is enough to say that there is absolutely no way for us to reap the immeasurable benefits of Tantra if our motivation is centered on our own welfare alone. The only type of person for whom Tantra can work is someone who is primarily concerned with benefiting others and sees the tantric path as the quickest and most powerful way of accomplishing this altruistic aim. Secondly, we must have the patience and self-discipline to engage in the practices in a well-ordered manner. To think as many people do, since Tantra is the highest path, it is not necessary for me to bother about the preliminary practices. And then jump into the most advanced teachings is both foolish and arrogant. It is also very dangerous. Anyone who has such an impatient and unrealistic attitude is completely unqualified to receive instructions in Tantra. Finally, it is very important to be able to differentiate clearly between the essence of Tantra and the cultural forms in which it is currently wrapped. What I mean by this is that there is no benefit in a Westerner's pretending to look or act like a Tibetan, nor any other Asian for that matter. Learning to say prayers in a foreign language, for instance, is not in itself the way to fill our highest human potential. There is nothing of transcending value to be gained from substituting one set of cultural conventions for another. People whose practice remains on this superficial level end up with nothing but confusion, not knowing who they are or what they should do. Of course, during this time of transition when the tantric teachings are moving from the East to the West, there is a lot to be gained from the study of the Tibetan language and so forth. But my point is that we should always bear in mind that Tantra is something far deeper than language or custom. What Tantra has to teach us is a way of breaking free from all the conditioning that limits our understanding of who we are and what we can become. If we approach these powerful energies with clear-sighted intelligence and a strong determination to extract their essence, we can definitely bring to our life the wholeness and inner satisfaction that we all seek.